This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm T. Xiao Yik. Here on BFM's health segment, we've talked a lot about helping children with autism spectrum disorder, otherwise known as ASD, whether it's in terms of early identification or early intervention. What has not been discussed as much is how adults with ASD manage, especially when it comes to employment. How do they find their place in life as productive working members of society? We have in the studio with us Michael Carley, a speaker, author and consultant who was himself diagnosed with ASD as an adult, as well as Dr. Choi Suk-Kwin, representing both Autism Initiatives Malaysia and Entrepreneurs Organisation, or EO Malaysia. I'm going to start off with a direct question, Michael. Can you work if you have autism?
Absolutely. Very often, I think you can actually work better, given the right circumstances and the right supports. People with autism in the past were very often, I think, not directly shunned, I think, from the employment workplace simply because they were different, but they were also given too many signs and lessons throughout their upbringing that they were not prepared for employment. And so, you know, it was a stigma that was coming from within as well as from the employment communities themselves. But we have now learned through whether it's Silicon Valley or all of these famous individuals like Albert Einstein, Thomas Edison, Thomas Jefferson, Beethoven, Mozart, Emily Dickinson, all the world's great mathematicians who have been diagnosed in retrospect as having autism spectrum disorders, that of course the potential is there for great, great works to be done in an employment situation.
You know, one notable one is Temple Grandin as well. She works in animal husbandry and she's used her skills to think about how animals view the world. I was very fascinated by her story.
It's a great story.
Yeah.
Temple is, to me, you know, especially most heroic, not just because of her autism diagnosis, but because if you ever get a chance to listen to her, ask her about what it was like to work on a cattle ranch in Colorado in the 1960s. And because she was the only woman on that ranch, some of the nonsense that she took, and what you'll quickly learn from that particular conversation is that what really helped Temple as a person was the fact that she was just tough as nails. Mm. And she let the small stuff roll off her back. Now, hopefully in employment situations now, people aren't being exposed to those conditions that Temple had to go through. But it's getting more and more better in terms of, I think, you know, the rest of the world understanding what makes us different so that we can become more accommodated. But there's always also going to be a role for that ability to let the rest of the world's ignorance about autism roll off your back a little bit. I think that's always going to play a role in whether or not you succeed.
That's true. Michael, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. You were diagnosed with what was originally identified as Asperger's syndrome.
Correct.
And in the year of 2000, and you were how old at that time?
I was 36 years old.
You were 36, so in adulthood. Now it's been reclassified as ASD. Mm-hmm. What was the impact of the diagnosis on your life? And I've read about the turbulent years, you know, you spent growing up.
Sure. I wish I had the words to tell you the biblical weight that gets lifted off your shoulders in a tremendous amount, because all through your life, you have these giant questions where relationships suddenly end and you don't understand why. But you also know from experience, because it's happened so many times, that you don't have the tools to make it better, so you just let the relationship go. Mm-hmm. But on the other end, maybe people think that you're an absolute genius because, you know, I was one of the lucky ones who was thought to be talented, which gives you a free pass, especially in the time in which I grew up. And, you know, you realize very quickly how very lucky you were that people actually thought that you were more intelligent than you really are. And, you know, it's just you realize, I think, you're growing up and you get it. You're different. Mm-hmm. But you don't know why. Mm-hmm. You know that the people that clearly aren't very fond of you, that they're not people that you want to hang around with that much, and they don't get you very well. But there's also the crowd of people that, because you're thought of as talented, and again, this is very few of us had the luck that I had to have this happen to them, but you also realize they don't get you either. Mm. But you're, of course, going to go hang out with them rather than the crowd that isn't too crazy about you, because we want to enjoy ourselves and be, you know, filled with positive influences in our lives. So And at the same time, I got the diagnosis because of my then 4-year-old son. And I can take pride in the fact that that kid isn't going to have all the messiness that I had growing up, where people thought I was just rude all the time when I would speak my mind. And that's, from a father's perspective, that's a massive difference. So it was wonderful for me because it answered so many questions. And especially because I think I'd gotten it into my head that maybe I just was a very rude person. And I had become acclimated to the fact, well, I guess I'm a rude person. I don't want my life to end because I'm a rude person, so I'm going to move on. But I'm just going to adjust to the fact that I'm rude and that I'm still going to try and make great accomplishments in my life as I can and have a wonderful family, even though I'm a rude person. And then somebody comes along and tells you, guess what? You're not a rude person. This is about your wiring, not your character. And I wish I had the words to tell you, because that's the weight that gets lifted off your shoulders.
It must have been like a switch just lit up.
Incredible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I spent probably the next 2 months with my 4-year-old. We lived very close to a wonderful place in New York City called the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. And just like any other botanical gardens, you know, everything's just beautiful. And he and I walked through those gardens every single day for about 90 days after I got – not 90, 60 days after I got diagnosed. And I was processing and realizing that I had to reimagine every experience I'd ever had as a child during those 60 days and having, you know, lots of beautiful flowers, you know, as well as this child you love alongside you, really allowed me to sort of process this and figure out that, you know, all the people maybe, let's say, that I thought were being nice to me were just really keeping me at arm's distance. And so many people that I thought had been mean to me, I realized, oh my gosh, they were challenging me. They had faith that I could do things, and I thought that they were being mean to me. So you're really reinterpreting like every event through this new context, through this new filter, which you now know about yourself.
Dr. Choi, what Michael has described also explains this generational difference. He was diagnosed in adulthood. His son has had the opportunity to be diagnosed at an early age. For us here in Malaysia, have you seen the acceptance of autism as a condition that people live with improving over the years?
The answer would be yes, and that's very encouraging, because right now the early intervention awareness has been very active, and typically a family will get a diagnosis around age 4, which can be earlier. However, what is not so apparent are for the adults. And that's why we want to have this platform in AIM to, again, open that door to be a catalyst to be aware and diagnose even the adults.
Dr. Choi, we also hear the terms neurotypical and neurodiversity being used in relation to the range of intellectual and developmental norms that you see in society, in a population. What do these terms mean?
So what we want to share with the public is this new and very encouraging term, just as what Michael had said just now. You know, when you know your wiring, so diversity suggests that you can be wired. Your brain is the most complex organ in your whole body. So it enables a language that shows that you are different. In simple terms, everybody is made different. And so is your brain. And in the wiring, you have the diverse brain. And with a diverse brain, therein then you have the different attributes, from being very focused, from having specific attention, to be very attentive. So these are the positive attributes that you will find in autism, or people with diagnosed with autism, that we want to introduce, the new language. So we were just sharing yesterday in EO Malaysia session how you have neurotypical, and that would be like you, myself, yes, and then we have the neurodiverse. How we can look at that in a workplace is really, even in normal circumstances of us hiring, we will be looking at profiling. And in the past, our conventional profiling will put, you may use different tools, yeah? What is your character? But right now, we are not talking only about character. We're just talking about the different positive attributes that you may have that as an employer, you can actually tap into that attribute. For example, if you work in ICT and they are very good analytically and numerically, that is a positive attribute a employer can work with. If you are creative, and there are many misperceptions that people with autism are rigid. Now, if we use that, if we understand that they have a neurodiverse brain, they could also be creative. Their brain is going to be more wired up on the right side of the brain, and you will find that these creative people are already in the workplace and they are amazing, maybe graphic artists or even PR companies people.
I would add to, you know, to what Dr. Choi just said too, in the context that both of them, I think, have tremendously positive social origins, both of these words. Neurodiversity especially, you know, really stems from the fact that whether we're talking about autism or whether we're talking about other non-apparent disabilities, the definitions keep changing. Mm. And they're changing drastically because we're learning so much at such a fast rate that it's hard for everybody to keep track of where we're at right now in terms of what label means this and, you know, and how they're changing. And one of the things that, you know, I always sort of try and keep in mind in my work is, well, what's all this stuff going to look like 100 years from now when we just think of it, hopefully, as normal extensions of the human experience? Mm. So I think neurodiversity, especially when we get away from autism, when we get into things like other learning disabilities or psychological disabilities, that we start to understand that these are also communities of people that are trying to take charge of the words and take ownership of them as well, just as we did 15 years ago in the autism community, which I think is a very positive thing. So if we have this, you know, word for neurodiversity, it really, I think, allows for people to understand that what's really at root here in terms of the disconnect between, let's say, us and the rest of the world are merely a difference in processing thoughts, emotions, and experiences. So it's a great word for us to have that allows for the clinical, you know, folks to go ahead and make whatever changes you want to whatever words are out there. We're always going to know that it's a neurodiversity, you know, platform. And on the word neurotypical, I would imagine that, you know, if I was a neurotypical, that I would be deeply insulted by somebody who referred to me as normal. Now, not only do I not want to think of myself as abnormal, I would imagine that you would be very insulted by that because it really robs you of the potential to be just as much of an individual as I am when you're called normal.
Or average.
Exactly. You know, and normal is, you know, it's a word, you know, that belongs on a washing machine. And that's about it. You know, if we use the word neurotypical, then it allows for you to have just as much individuality as an individual who is neurodiverse.
Okay, fantastic. Very fascinating. I've been speaking to Michael Carley, a speaker, author, and consultant with Autism Spectrum Disorder, as well as Dr. Choi Suk Kwin from Entrepreneurs Organization Malaysia, and we're discussing autism in the workplace. After the break, we'll hear more about the challenges that people with ASD face in getting employed. You're listening to BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show with me, T. Xiao Yik. We're talking about autism and employment with Michael Carley, a speaker, author, and consultant with Autism Spectrum Disorder, as well as Dr. Choi Suk Kwin from Entrepreneurs Organization Malaysia. She's also representing Autism Initiatives Malaysia. Before the break, we were talking about terms like neurotypical and neurodiversity to explain the range of intellectual and developmental abilities that the population displays, and that nobody belongs in just one norm. Let's move on to how people with autism cope in the workplace. In the first instance, there must be a lot of prejudice that you face from people who just simply don't understand the condition. What would some of these prejudices or misconceptions be?
I think that if you really look at how, you know, we wake up on a certain side of the bed every morning and we, you know, sort of make these subconscious decisions about whether to look at the world in a positive light or a negative light. And if you come across anything that is unknown, unfortunately, I think we all go to the negative. If you bring city kids into the country, you know, they hear bugs they've never heard before and they just want to kill everything that moves. Mm-hmm. If you bring country kids into the city, they want to know why all these weird people aren't locked up. It's just human nature that we are all terrified of the unknown. Mm-hmm. And so when differing behaviors start, you could look and interpret things in the negative, such as that they're lazy, that they're slow, that they're inappropriate in their behaviors, whereas if you looked at things in a positive light, you could say, wow, there's a great attention to detail. Wow, look at the memory for facts and figures. Wow, look at the outside-the-box thinking, which is what's most important usually to corporations. And I think what we're really just doing is we're starting to understand how we all behave better in terms of, again, that tendency to steer towards the negative instinctively. And now we're working to reverse that. Now we're looking to really make sure that we look initially at the positives. And we understand that thinking in a positive manner like that doesn't come to us naturally, that we have to work hard at it. And that once that happens, then suddenly we're going to see these incredible attributes of these incredible people that, you know, could amount to, again, all those famous names that we went over in the beginning.
Mm. Yes. Dr. Choi, do you feel or have you observed that in Malaysia, where I know you said things have improved, but autism is still not as recognized as it is in the developed world, what are the barriers that people with autism face to getting employment?
I think In the current, there are already over 100 companies that hire people with disabilities. That's the conventional hire. But right now, there are going to be more. That we already know companies that are already hiring people with autism. Now, the difficulties really is exactly what Michael has shared, is when you are afraid. In other words, when you are not aware. When the employers or even the team at the human resource department, the recruiters, are not aware yet, so they may not be bold to take that step to hire. Now, again, this word, hidden disabilities. When many of them at adult age have not been diagnosed nor assessed, they come across what the term they always use is behaviorally. You know, this guy is really odd. Mm. But in essence, if you are aware, and you are not only aware, but you are equipped to say, actually, I want this particular attribute in my role that I'm hiring, you will step up towards the next step, which is having the understanding and being bold enough to take the hiring position. So there are many things. We have always typically worked with the client or the adult with autism, but really the big step now is how we can equip the communities around them, the people who your staff in the company, the first person really is the human resource team. So that is we see that not as a difficulty, really we see that as opportunities. Yeah.
Michael, would you advise somebody with autism to right up front, perhaps at the very first job interview, say, you know, I have autism?
It's a great question, and it's one that we struggle with, I think, throughout the world. And I think that it really just depends on the individual's particular challenges. It's going to be reflective sometimes of their knowledge of the corporate culture to which they're applying for. It's going to be, a gut call, whether or not you think that that company that you're heading into or that you're applying for is behaviorally permissive enough to make you feel like you're still a valued employee. Mm-hmm. If you disclose what you have. I think that the situation, it's too situation specific to put, you know, a generality on it. But if I may, actually, I'd love to, you know, sort of jump in on, you know, what Dr. Choi was saying too about, you know, Malaysia in general, if I can put my ex-diplomat hat on here for a second. And, you know, from my perspective, because of this huge change in government in which you've all just, you know, undergone, you have a massive opportunity right now. I don't get the sense that people see that. And I want people, you know, to not think of themselves as, quote unquote, behind, you know, mm-hmm. which I think people have that sort of mindset sometimes. You know, where I come from, we should have been eons more ahead than we actually are, because we made huge mistakes in our evolution of how we think and how we process people process the whole notion of how we're going to integrate the autism spectrum into our daily consciousness. You know, we spent so much time, and we're still spending so much time, eradicating thoughts that this stuff comes from vaccines. We spent so much time trying to unwork, you know, the really inhumane messaging of larger organizations that say that they are for people with autism, and yet who, you know, used in their messaging, well, people with autism, you know, have lives that just aren't worth living as much as ours. And that's how they raised their money, was talking about autism in the tragedy sense. Mm. You know, they had this really emotionally unhealthy desire to blame something. Somebody had to be at fault. Somebody had to be punished. And that's just the wrong way to go about integrating anybody into a healthy situation. So you can avoid those things. You don't have that stuff to unravel. You've got a clean slate, and you also have a new government that really, you know, is hoping, I think, to fill Malaysia people with, you know, excitement and with hope. And here's an opportunity for them to start funding services that haven't been funded by the government prior to this. You have unique partners for the government to team up with, such as the Entrepreneurs Organization that hosted yesterday's event, as well as AIM, if not OASIS itself, from a service perspective. And, you know, the PR advantage is, given the positive iconography surrounding autism now, it's a win-win for the government, and I hope they take advantage.
Speaking of AIM, Autism Initiatives Malaysia, Dr. Choi, what are you hoping to push for in terms of better policies, not only in terms of employment, but across the spectrum?
You know, just like Michael said, this really is like Providence giving that new timing. At AIM, we would like to be the catalyst for the adults in autism, to open up the platform for adults who can advocate for themselves. And our ambassador, Dr. Daniel Leong, who's a co-chair with myself, have been going around universities on roadshows to promote the awareness for the adults. So as a catalyst, really we want to ensure that the platform then also promotes the need to support what is ultimately independent living. And that comes into employment, it comes in good further education, and that is to promote just being. Being an adult with autism is just part of the whole community. That is our key role.
You know, you mentioned earlier, Michael, about how it was the stigma within themselves, within those who have autism, that was holding them back from, you know, discovering their potential. Does this mean that there's a huge role to be played by programs that help children transition to adulthood?
Absolutely. We had a television show in the United States called The Twilight Zone. Mm-hmm. And there's a very famous episode it was a show that aired in the early 1960s. And there's a very famous episode of this show where this really racist guy wakes up one morning and he's African American. And that notion of suddenly realizing that you are your worst fears is one that I saw too many times when I was running GRASP, which is the largest organization for adults on the spectrum, and where people who were just raised to believe that, you know, anybody with a disability was broken, or that they were second-class human beings. And suddenly later on in life, they get the diagnosis. Those people ran for the hills. You know, you hear them say things like, well, I'll just deal. And they don't deal. That's the exact opposite of what they do. It's those that can really look in the mirror and sort of, you know, say, okay, how do we work with this? Or isn't this a relief? Now I know, you know, I'm not the bad guy that everybody thought I was. That's how we're going to make that transition.
Are we doing enough in Malaysia, Dr. Choi, to avoid that kind of a dilemma?
You know, I think we must always be grateful. Being in a position of influence within AIM, this is not something that is just new. There has been a lot of work. We need to honor what has been and still is ongoing in the early childhood intervention. And there have been many, including the National Early Childhood Intervention Council. So this is really a timely progression. We don't think it's too late. We have a great opportunity to start, as Michael has said repeatedly to us, a clean slate. And that is the opportunity that I think we would like to advocate towards, that it is going to be the positive that we want to share the attribute. Certainly, we need to acknowledge what is challenging, but as overcoming individuals, overcoming organizations, overcoming communities, we would choose to take that positive approach.
And I would add also to that, and thank you, Dr. Choi, for that, that, you know, this is another instance where I do, because it's a great question, that it would be a mistake maybe to look at how we've done things. Because you get this diagnosis not because of a blood test or an MRI or an absolute. You get it because of interpreted behavioral differences. And those interpreted behavioral differences, they pass through cultural filters. And in every culture, you're going to have different definitions for whether or not, you know, those differences present with positives or negatives. So Malaysia really has to do this through the context of Malaysia and Malaysia only. The only thing that I think is a good rule to sort of hold is that when we look at, okay, what constitutes a human being in general? We look at their gender. We look at their race. We look at their ethnicity. We look at their sexual orientation. We look at how much money their parents have. And we look at the quality of supports that they have as well. And if you were to figure out amongst all of those, well, which one of these is the most important? It's easily quality of supports. If you're raised to feel good about who you are, no matter who you are, you've got a shot. But if you're raised to think badly about who you are, you're going to have a much harder time.
So there's a lot of entrenched values that we need to change. I've been speaking to Michael Carley, a speaker, author and consultant with Autism Spectrum Disorder, as well as Dr. Choi Suk-Win from Entrepreneurs Organization Malaysia. And we're discussing autism in the workplace. Don't go anywhere. After the break, we'll ask Dr. Choi about where adults with ASD can get support and training to succeed in the workplace. You're listening to BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show with me, T. Xiao Yik. We're talking about autism and employment with Michael Carley, a speaker, author and consultant with ASD, as well as Dr. Choi Suk-Win from Entrepreneurs Organization Malaysia. I would like to ask you, Michael, very frankly, we associate certain behaviours with people who have autism, as you've mentioned before as well. There are sensory, social, communication and behavioural issues that you have to deal with. How's that going to come into play at the workplace?
I think when you have an agreement somehow that is, you know, even if it's subliminal and nobody knows that an agreement has been made, you have the people who are neurotypical who have somehow decided to let their behavioral standards be changed to accommodate somebody. And sometimes that has to be a very conscious effort. And sometimes on our end, because it is a relationship, we might too have to bend. And I think that you can get our population to bend no matter what the functionality level if you more appeal to our pragmatic nature. Because we do have that logic-based, you know, notion inside of our brains that I think, you know, there's an inroad. It's when people start to try and, you know, maybe get us to change using things like euphemisms or sarcasm or soliloquies that have hidden text and hidden meaning, or what we call the hidden curriculum, which we're just not going to get. We need people to be absolutely clear. And the beauty of this, especially from a corporate standpoint and from a workplace standpoint, is what nobody realizes is that everybody likes to say, oh, we're good communicators. From my standpoint, nobody's a good communicator. People are rarely good communicators. They're too afraid. Mm. They're too scared. And our population forces folks like you, if you'll forgive me, okay, to become infinitely better communicators. Mm-hmm. And if you're a corporation in which, you know, suddenly your managers are becoming better communicators, your corporation is going to flourish.
Okay. That's a lot to wrap my head around.
That's my job.
But linked to that, I think, is if people just simply don't want to change to accommodate the others who are more diverse, I would imagine what you'd get is a lot of harassment or bullying. How common is that?
It's very common. It's very common. We have a long road to go. I think that the success stories are getting really good press, and that's, you know, something that we have to be thankful to people like you for. So thank you for that. But I think that also the success stories are still just one page out of War and Peace. We have a very, very long way to go. We have a lot of resistance, I think, still. You know, we're emerging out of real cultural dinosaur periods, all of us, no matter where we come from. And so it's, I think, going to be dependent on enough awareness and exposure so that, let's say, if we use shame as a tactic, you know, in order to show, you know, the success stories that certain companies are doing, you know, to maybe more of a degree than we normally would when we're covering a story. That's what's going to get the companies that are lagging behind to do the catch-up, is when they see their competitors flourishing.
Dr. Choi, what has to change in terms of a company's management and HR policies? Because we can talk as much as we want to have policies and statements about inclusiveness, but how are you working with companies to really get them to embrace people with autism as part of their workforce?
Again, it comes back to having an understanding and having the confidence to take that the brave step. In a conventional hiring process, typically you have the interview process, and we know and we continue to learn that you want, when you want to hire your talent, that may not be a great one to use for the adults with autism. There are now new processes of interviewing. We need to learn how that is. It is maybe through a job assessment on the job. It can be through a internship. It can be through mock interviews. So this suggests that corporates who are going to take that positive step to take advantage of hiring talent need to upskill. That is the call to the challenge to the HR department and recruitment teams, that they need upskilling to be enabled to tap that talent.
You know, if I can actually interject, if you don't mind too, one of the reasons why I always wanted to get into the autism employment aspect of things back when I was running GRASP was because I was realizing from afar that from our end, which we would call maybe the nonprofit or the charity organization perspective, that our messaging to the corporations was really bad. And it was bad for a long time because we would appeal to businesses in the same context that a nonprofit or a charity organization works. And we'd say, you should do this because it's the right thing to do, or you should do this because it's going to help people. And I, as a nonprofit executive, if I'm hiring somebody, I would look at a resume, and if I saw a really noble failure where somebody bit off more than they could chew, but it was a fantastic project, I would love that resume and the person that had that resume, because to me that said that they were willing to take risks and that they were willing to go out on a limb. But if I'm running a for-profit, if I'm running a corporate corporation, that's the first resume in the trash can, because I have shareholders to answer to. It's just a very different reality. And we on the charity end, for all those years, were just not making the businesses confident that they could make the relationship work, because it just, there wasn't enough in it for them. If they try something out with a population of, let's say, people with autism in their workplace, and it doesn't go so well, they don't get a clean slate. They get criticism, and their shareholders rebel against them. It's a very different reality. So not only do we have to learn their language, you know, we have to learn to use the word implement five times more than we normally have, or, you know, deliverables and
KPIs.
Stuff like that. Exactly, exactly. You know, we also have to, you know, sell these folks on them from a bottom line perspective. Hire more autistic people, you will make more money, whether it's through PR or their productivity. That's how we're going to convince them.
Can you actually prove that? I mean, would they ask for data? Are they?
If you look at the statistics about the fact that more diverse companies outperform their peers, yes, we do have the data.
And we're talking about diversity in all
correct.
Areas, right?
Correct.
We're not just talking about
not just autism. Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
I would also like to say that you know, and you will get to see it if you are a participant at the AIM Symposium. We actually get testimonies. These are people who are hiring, who are already hiring, testimonies of how they themselves are originally not so convinced, but when they were bold to take that step, they had all the positive, outstanding, in fact, performance from the staff who are autistic. So it is something you need to experience. It's experiential. And in Malaysia, I would say, if I observe of the interest in the entrepreneur organizations meeting, there were very keen interests, asking of questions, wanting to know and to adopt how this can happen in the company. So the new Malaysia, new hope, the new platform really, I believe, is going to take a nice flight off. Yeah.
What kind of structured programs is EO Malaysia implementing, if I may steal that word, implementing to really put the focus on autism in the workplace?
Okay, we are, again, at this very beginning of the journey, and we have made a call to action to our members when we ended the session is, are you ready to provide mock interviews? Are you ready to provide internship? Are you ready to hire? So there are you ready also to train to hire? So we are at the baby and initial step, and we are very excited about that.
Does EO Malaysia only work with entrepreneurs?
EO Malaysia is a member organization of business people, and the answer is we work with not only business people, but as a reach out to the younger potential entrepreneurs, we have two key programs, which is the accelerators, and these are young business people who have not who are building their business towards the $1 million mark, and we also work with students in universities and colleges in the Global Student Entrepreneurship Program to also encourage them into entrepreneurship.
What can we do then to go into all the other industries that are really ripe for employment?
You know, within the EO Malaysia membership ourselves, we currently have about 143 members in Malaysia only. We are already represented in the whole breadth of industries, from retailing to hospitality to real estate to IT to security. So within this platform, and we are a member of a global network which are in many countries, and I think that reach can start as a dot here and ripple out in the whole EO global organization.
Michael, forgive me if this sounds like a stereotype, but are there certain industries that are more suited for people with ASD?
I struggle with that question. It's a great question, because I think historically, you know, there was this idea that we were all meant for, you know, doing either data input or data interpretation. And I think that the reality is more along the lines that we're pretty much destined for any job that's out there. You know, I kind of have a little bit of a joke that, you know, is partially funny because it's based in truth, and that is that really the natural profession for all of us is anthropologist, because we're trying to figure out how this strange world that we find ourselves in actually works, and that no matter, you know, where we are on the planet, everybody else to us is a foreign culture.
That's absolutely right.
And so, you know, we have those skills in which we're trying to figure out. You know, it's very funny because, like, the younger kids, I think, on the spectrum, they like to use the word wrong planet. You know, that I found myself on the wrong planet. And that's kind of a fun, you know, analogy. But I actually liken it as a fairly aligned parallel with the immigrant experience, no matter where you are. Because when you're an immigrant, you suddenly find yourself in this strange land. But you know that if you want to, you know, make a lot of money, be able to support a family or whatever, you're going to have to do X amount of acclimating to the culture in which you find yourself in. And that means some learning. But at the same point, when you go home at night, you can't be pretending that you're from the culture that you found yourself in. You have to be true to who you are to maintain your sense of mental health and be proud of who you are.
So you have to accept that you are never really going to be part of what people call the norm.
Correct.
But that's fine.
Correct. To do otherwise is simply self-hatred. That's pure and simple.
Yes. So on that note, since we're talking about, you know, for people with autism to find careers that are rewarding for themselves, that are meaningful, not just any form of employment, would you have a final message for us?
I think, not to pigeonhole and not to stereotype, I think like every kid these days, you know, so many of the young people on the autism spectrum all want to be video game designers. And, you know, it's
every
like...
Every child.
Exactly, exactly. And in my day, you know, that was like acting, you know, where it was like, there's going to be some stiffer competition than you may know about. I would say to keep your mind open. I don't think that there's any profession that hasn't been passionately looked at by an individual on the autism spectrum as something that they would love to do.
Dr. Choi?
And I think a call to further educators as well as to employers, really, you, as with things that bear good results and fruits, you need to make that investment. And when you invest in this, you will get good outcomes and results that will always come back into your bottom line. So take that bold step.
And I would add to that, you know, again, that's this new government that has come in and all the hope that, you know, comes along with it. This is just a win-win opportunity for them from both a PR perspective as well as a social services, you know, perspective.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Michael Carley, a speaker, author, and consultant who was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder as an adult, as well as Dr. Choi Soo-Kwin, representing both Autism Initiatives Malaysia and Entrepreneurs Organization Malaysia, and we've been talking about autism in the workplace. Now, if you're interested in learning disabilities affecting children, join us at the Health and Living Junior event this Saturday on the 6th of October, where we have sessions on learning, vaccination, eyesight, and even gadget addiction. There will be activities for children, so bring your family and join us. This is your last chance to register for the group promo. Just go to www.bfm.my/health event. You've been listening to The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.